someone right in the beginning of visit with Leslie this Saturday, supper the 23rd of December, 72. Channel 1 right in the beginning of visit with Leslie this Saturday at supper the 23rd of December, 72. Now, this is just half of it. I'm keeping it because at the end of Channel 1 right is some that's not on the other reel. Channel 1 right at supper the 23rd of December, 72 with Leslie. Channel 1 right, and beginning the visit with Leslie this Saturday at supper, 23rd of December, 72. This is incomplete. This is just half of it, but the tail end of Channel 1 right has something that the other reel doesn't have. This is beginning the visit with Channel 1 right, beginning the visit with Leslie this Saturday, the supper, the 23rd of December, 72.
That's good. I think I like this one much better than the other one.
Now that's the one where they went up the mountain. Find the grandfather's
house,
or homestead.
Yeah, up in the mountain.
Now, does that sound?
It sounds very reasonable, authentic to me.
Authentic.
That the god would be real old and walk real fast, for example.
Yeah.
Fairly typical. We had a god like that when we went up. Above Delphi, the whole school went up on a
excuse me, make it all racket. I just trying to.
We went on a hike above Delphi on to the Corician Cave, which is a cave that was sacred to some of the nymphs in ancient times. And it's quite high up on the slopes of Mount Parnassus. But we had this old guy who was actually the foreman of the French archaeological school there. He normally directed the Greek workmen. But he also hired himself out sometimes as a guide. And he must have been about 65 or 70, but he just went right up the side without any trouble. All of us men, of course, walked, but we couldn't really keep up with him, but a number of the girls were on muleback. It was such a steep climb. Another place where you can see, I guess it's just that their lungs and hearts are much better than ours, but at Theura, you know, when you come in on the boat at the base of the town there, there's that very steep winding stairway that goes up to the top. I think it's 572 steps, and it is steps. There are these long steps, about a yard long. And you go up on mule or donkey back, and they pay, well, if you go the going rate, you pay about 15 cents. Usually you get cheated and pay much more than that, but the going rate's about 15 cents. But there's always someone that leads your mule or donkey up, and it's nearly always a person aged 85 or 90, and often a woman. It's quite remarkable how they just walk right up.
Now, did you talk to any of the guides?
Yeah, talked to some of them. We, actually, when we went up, we arrived, and it was in 1967, in September, after the tourist season. We arrived at about 7 a.m. It was very early in the morning, and we were very tired because we hadn't been able to sleep too much on the boat. We had gotten ourselves a bed down in the hold from the very bottom of the boat. But there was this old man in our cabin who was getting off at 5 o'clock, and he got up at about 3 and turned on the overhead light and spent an hour and a half getting ready to leave. So we didn't get the light off until nearly 5, so we were awfully tired. We got off, and there was this boy who had 3 mules, which is what we would need, one for each of us to ride on and then one to carry our baggage. So he said he'd take us up and that he would take us to a hotel, too. So up we went, and we finally got to the top, and he took us all around the back way to the far end of the town to this little hotel. And then he charged us an enormous amount for the mules. I can't remember what it was, but foolish as we had been, we hadn't checked on the price before we went up, of course, so we had no choice but to pay. And it made us so short of money, I think that we had to go and cash a personal check at the local bank. I'm sure I'm the only person who's ever cashed a personal check in dollars. It was for $10 on the island of Thera. The thing that finally convinced the clerk that I had some money in my account and that he should cash the check was that I took out my check register. And in my own handwriting, of course, I had records of what I had spent and what I had not. And I just showed him that, and I showed him my balance. And he took that as something from the bank. And he tore out that page, I remember. He tore out that page with my balance for the end of the month or whatever. And then he cashed the check for $10, and we were able to get off the island. But the interesting thing is that when I arrived on the island of Thera last summer, let's see, that would be 5 years later, I came back, and I arrived in the evening, and I was coming in on a boat, and everyone on the boat was asking me about how you got from the dock up to the town and various things like that. And I thought I knew all about it. I was telling them that there were these mules, and that when you got off, you could get a mule, and that you shouldn't pay too much, but the mule would take you up to the top, and then you could get a hotel in the public square there. So the boat docked at about 10 p.m., and everyone got off very tired and hungry, and there were no mules to be seen. There was not a mule in sight. There was just a great crowd of people trying to get onto this bus, which was perhaps about as big as this kitchen. It was an old military bus of about 1939 vintage. Looked like a school bus. You remember how they looked. It was, I'm sure it was American. And it held probably about 20 people seated and a few others in the aisles. But immediately it filled with about 100 people and it took off. And I didn't even know that there was any road down to the dock. And so I was completely surprised to find this bus, and I didn't get on it. Usually I'm always the first one on anything because I know how Greece is. But this particular time I got off, I was so confused I didn't rush onto the bus in time. So I didn't get on it, and it left without me. And of course all the cabs had been reserved for first class passengers, and they wouldn't take anybody either. But there was a crowd of about 150 people. And the island of Thera, since it's a volcano ring, it's the top, you know, of the cone of a volcano, is very steep on the inside. The boats come in and dock on the inside of the rim, which is very steep. And that's why that staircase leading up to the town is so very steep. Well, I didn't have very much luggage, and I thought, well, I'll just walk up the 500 and however many steps I can make it. So I went over and asked one of the Greeks there, if I could walk up to the top. And he said, why, of course you can walk up to the top, but nobody's done that for years. You'll probably get killed. Why don't you come over and sit in my cafe and have an ouzo or something, and then when the bus comes back, I'll take you up in the bus and I'll give you some rooms in my hotel, which is really nice, etc., etc., etc. Well, I was pretty sure that he was giving me a bum steer, particularly about the hotel, because I was with a group of some other people that I had sort of met on the bus, and on the boat rather, and it was, I wanted a single room, and one couple wanted a double room, and then these other people wanted a triple room. And so I explained that to the man, and he said, that's exactly what I have. I have one single room, one double room, and one triple room. And it's all available for 20 drachs a head, which is very reasonable, even for the island. Well, somehow I was just too tired to go up the steps. And that saved me. But we waited and waited and waited, and finally, after at least an hour and a half, the bus came back, and we got on the bus along with all the other people. I have never seen such a crowded bus. And we took off on this road, which was just in order to get up the steep side of the rim, It would run way down in one direction, and then it would make a curve, and then it would run all the way down in the other direction, and it would make the other curve of the zigzag, and it would run all the way back. And every time you made one of these curves in this bus, you know, you'd be out, and I was sitting next to the window. You would look out, and all you would see would be the water miles below with nothing between you and it. And the bus was so terribly overcrowded that it was really very frightening to go up this thing. And all the time, you kept having the feeling, you know, if only they had those nice mules, we'd have been there hours ago. You have to consider we had waited over an hour and a half for the bus. And it took a long time for it to drive up. And I kept thinking about how everything is always ruined by supposed technological advances. You know, really it was much better to go up on the mules. It gave the local population money and jobs, and it was much quicker and pleasanter than the 1939 bus. Well, then we finally got up to the top, to the rim, and I thought, well, we'll be right in the town, because the harbor is right below the town, but we didn't come out anywhere near the town. In fact, we were 5 miles away from the town. I learned this the next day when I went for a hike from one end of the island to the other, and I passed the turnoff for this particular road, and it was a good, probably almost 5 miles from the town. Well, of course, before it went to the town, it went to every other town on the island, or at least three or four others. And the cafe owner got off at one of the first stops. It developed that his rooms, whatever their price and whatever their arrangement, were not in the center of the town. And in fact, they were way out on the island somewhere. And that's why they were so cheap. But fortunately, we didn't get off there. I did know that the place where his rooms were was not the right place to get off. So finally, we got back to the town of Thera, and we got off the bus. And the boat had been so crowded that we were quite worried that we would not be able to find any rooms in the town, because it was getting quite late, and this was the second bus up. But these old men met us, and they took us to rooms which they said were right near the center of the town. Naturally, they turned out to be at the far end of the town. But the irony of it was that just as we were checking into the room, and I mentioned to one of the old men, I said, well, how on earth are we going to get anything to eat? It's quite late, and we're so far from the center of the town. What have you done to us? You've brought us all the way up here in the middle of nowhere, and we're starving to death. And he said, well, there's a little restaurant right over there. And he pointed up ahead to where there was sort of a street light, one of the few, and I immediately recognized the little restaurant and the little church where we had stayed when we had been there 5 years before. So he had brought us to exactly the same part of town, which, even though it was far away from the center, was a really delightful place. It had a beautiful view out over the lower town and out over the center of the volcano. And the restaurant, I had remembered, was fantastic. We had tried to eat in the town once before, and we had given up and gone back to this little restaurant. So I went into the restaurant with these two English people, who were much more out of sorts than I, at not having had dinner at 8, and who should be there sweeping the floor but the boy who had cheated us on the mules 5 years before. So I didn't recognize him, of course, but he recognized me and was very friendly. And even though the restaurant had closed and they didn't have any more food, he persuaded his father to fix us an omelet or something, and so we didn't go to bed hungry. So it was quite a coincidence. Well, it was the next day before I found out what had happened about the road. They had, in the 5 year period since I had been there, opened up a new port about 5 miles further down the rim from the town. And the only boats which dock at the town and you go up on the mules from anymore are the cruise ships, the ones that come in during the day. And tourists get off and go up to the top and buy a few trinkets, and then they go back down. But the boats that come in from Athens that dock at night all go to this place called Athenio, about 3 or 4 miles down the center of the thing, and you take the boat, you take the bus rather, up to the top and drive all the way around to the town. Well, one of these people who had been listening to me down by the boat had overheard what I had said about walking up to the top on the 575 steps. And so he had actually tried to do this, and apparently there was some kind of a path going from this harbor up to the top, but it hadn't been used for a good many years, and it was very precipitous and dangerous. And this man got about halfway up to the top or something and almost collapsed, and he came to some kind of a house, and these people took him in and let him sleep on their living room floor or something. And the next morning they helped him get to the top, and he got back to the town of Thera. But he really had a harrowing experience because he tried to do this crazy thing, which was partly my fault, I guess, because I had been talking about how it was possible to do it.
How long have you been going over there, Leslie? Since 66?
65 was the first time I went. Summer of 65. So it's been 7 years I've been going off and on. I think the reason they built this road and harbor is they're, as so often, exploiting some kind of natural resource on the island. It's all volcanic, and they're getting something out of it. They quarry away an enormous amount of it. I don't know what it is they're getting. Maybe, what would it be? Not bauxite, I guess.
No idea.
Some kind of ash or something. And they're trucking it down that road to that little port.
What were the years that you spent over there? A couple of years?
'65? '66 to '68.
Oh.
Summer of 66 to the summer of 68.
And you stayed all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And then you've been back every summer, I think.
Just about. I have been every summer, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you that gives you a relief from Berkeley and places like that.
Yes, a much needed relief. Berkeley is so congested now.
It's nice to have some mules around and
yes.
Some little steamers and all.
Yes.
And the old men as guides. Well, that seems so far away and so long ago.
Well, Athens has changed an enormous amount in the past 2 or 3 years.
Go ahead.
Really a lot. At first it didn't seem to change very much, but now there's a big economic boom on, of course, and has been now for some years.
And when really money gets so plentiful, it just penetrates everywhere, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. The whole lifestyle change.
Limited. There's just so much money. There ought to be in circulation. after that point, it's mischief.
Right.
Mischievous.
But outside of Athens, things don't change so much. One occasionally notices this, like they will build a new road or something like that. But anyway, things are about the same.
Well, these. What
I was just going to say what interested me with these young girls, Candy and Betty. They went over there, and they were prepared just to love everything.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't see anything that displeased them. They were,
yeah.
It was just that great taste for everything Greek.
Yes.
That's very. It's somewhat unusual, I think, particularly when one of the girls is Greek, as Candy is. Very often they go and are very disappointed or very out of sorts with Greece because it doesn't have the modern conveniences or anything like that. You'd be surprised how many Greek Americans are really quite put out by that. They just don't understand why everything isn't as modern and nice and clean as it is over here. And of course, sometimes it can be frustrating, but it's interesting that these two were not at all affected in that way.
Well, it's hard to understand, isn't it? I mean, I wondered at it too, that they could do that. It seems just phenomenal that it would happen like that. And then they live to tell the story. You who do you depend on those is it grants from the foundations that you use?
Well, once I had a grant from a foundation. Usually the university has paid. Well, those 2 years when I was there, I was still a student, of course, and I won fellowships for that.
Yeah.
First year I won a competition from the American School in Athens itself, and the second year I had a Woodrow Wilson grant for dissertation writing.
Yeah.
But since that time, it's usually been a grant that's come from whatever university, first Cornell, and then later Berkeley has given me 2 grants.
Through your department?
Through the department, yes. But I think I'm about struck out at Berkeley for grants. I think I've gotten everything that there is to get. So next summer I probably won't have a grant. I haven't really thought of applying for one. I've decided that I'm going to try to go without a grant this summer and make a killing on the income tax and get it all back the following spring and see how that works. And then from then on, I should never need a grant again, because each spring I will get the refund from the preceding year, you see. And so then I should be able to finance each summer with that.
You know, they talk about these low fares.
It's not low fares. It really isn't. By the time you add in going from California,
yes,
instead of from the East Coast,
yes,
it's much more expensive to go to Athens than it is to go to, say, London. And you're not anywhere when you're in London, you know. It's a long way from London to Athens. Any way you go, it's a long way. I can't really live economically if I'm going to live near the school where I do most of my work, for example. That means I've got to take some kind of an apartment in that area of town. And I have this woman, Mrs. Andriades, who likes to go away for the summer, and she rents me her apartment when she's gone, but it's not really the kind of apartment I need. It has a bedroom, and living room, and dining room, and a maid's room off the kitchen, and a modern kitchen, and you know, it's really much, much larger than anything I need, and much more expensive than anything I need, but it's difficult to find a place for 2 months, you know. If I were staying for the whole year, I could live much more economically than just for the 2 months.
Yeah.
So it is expensive to go. What I hope to do this summer is to drive the car back here, and that will cut off the big air expense, which it's, any way you do it, even if you go by charter, it's about an additional $200 just to go from the West Coast over there instead of from the East Coast.
Sure.
Leave the car here and take a charter flight from New York and try to do it that way. For one thing, our house needs quite a bit of work on it, and a lot of it is things which I can do. So I think that I'm going to try to spend about 3 weeks here in June and July.
It'll do you good.
Maybe even longer, and try to get some of that work done.
Well, let me tell you, Leslie, I don't know how I got into this, but it... Oh, yes. We've been doing so many things on this, you know, this thing that you got into with Mr. Eastman.
Mm-hmm.
You see, I get into this too late to establish it myself.
Mm.
I don't have the vigor. And furthermore, I don't want to do it. I've had all of it I wanted. And what seemed plausible it was that if I could get a grant,
mm-hmm,
I could train some of these younger people,
mm-hmm,
and they could with a point of view and what they do with it. I don't. That's I don't know quite, but I mean eventually. But to start with, they could do a good bit of it.
Mm-hmm.
They could do a good bit. It's all such fresh territory, and you know what it does. I can take someone like Debbie, who's had a little experience now. They've got to have a little experience first. And she didn't have to listen to Mr. Eastman. She could listen to me. Or I tell you, Suzanne, we were out here 15th of August that year. Mm-hmm. Suzanne and Debbie and who else was it for you?
Rick.
And we all reported. It was like Mr. Eastman. She hadn't heard any of the reports. All she heard was this.
Mm-hmm.
And it got into her blood.
Mm-hmm.
And she took it in her, she took it with her to France all that year, next year. And she wrote back all the time those little reports. Just from being here that mm-hmm. one time. We just sat around the table. She hadn't even, but what it amounts to is, you see, that they can hear, now, Cookie came in the other day, and we hadn't seen him in 2 or 3 weeks. Things of his fortunes have changed greatly.
He struck it rich or what?
he's gone broke.
Oh.
But for one thing, he had tuberculosis and spent 6 months in the, place down there. And so he still doesn't wiggle too much.
Mm.
Well, now on top of that, they had a wreck.
Mm.
Two or three car wreck. $15,000-$20,000.
Mm.
So if Cookie works,
they get the money.
They get the money.
Oh.
And
I'll bet he doesn't work.
He's fully insured. Everybody fully insured. But the way it worked out, just by a hair's breadth, he lost out on ever out he had.
Oh.
Well.
Oh.
Anyhow, he still wiggles. And it's remarkable to say, move. He came up here. He wanted to come. He came himself. And he had been to West Virginia with Franklin. And he just had the whole thing just to lay out in front of him. Talk 2 hours or more. Everything. Frank was on drugs. He had taken to West Virginia. I mean, nothing private, all public information. Well, that's what handicaps most people now. They won't talk about anything. They'll quip and chatter.
Mm-hmm.
And be sort of Freudian, react to things, but none of it is worthwhile. But you see, he's not Freudian.
Well, and Debbie was.
And Debbie was sitting here listening to him, and she listened until she never listened that long. Until her central nervous system was paralyzed. She listened until, you see, she had read Faulkner and people like that.
Mm-hmm.
And you see, if Faulkner had done anything, he'd listen to talk.
Mm-hmm.
And here she was listening to the same talk he'd listened to. And it paralyzed her. Well, you see, she'll never get over it. And it was all informative.
Mm-hmm.
All sorts of information, you see.
That's what paralyzed it, because there's just so much.
He wrecked the car, and he told, I held it open for him, you see, and he told everything he did to get the car back going. He built a trailer, and he built it all over right there. At the end, I wanted him to talk about being a short order chef, and he was standing up right there where you are. And he would take a hamburger, he'd just reach over and take a hamburger steak and throw it on the griddle just like that, you see, and get his spatula and keep it going. I mean, he just brought it to life, the whole thing. And you see, that's after that, you see, they're already artists. Now, that's the artists of the old world, just like Mr. Eastman. They're performers.
Mm-hmm.
They don't know it. In a way, they do.
Yeah, they've been writing, you know, that's what she proposed to do, is to crystallize some of her experiences and just sort of put them down, not perform, but just so she wouldn't lose them. And Guy tried to keep them. These people drop in here all the time, and what we call the poet, Cookies, and Miss Mary, and all that. And we tried to keep it free so she wouldn't be involved in this.
Mm-hmm.
She has this in her system.
Yeah.
She needed to get that out. She said,
mm-hmm.
Well, Cookie came in one day and we didn't expect him. And
I tried to get rid of him.
We tried not to let him come in, but he was full of something. That was not.
I sent Debbie out there. I said, Debbie, get rid of him. I've got to work.
Well, that was the first time. So he came in, just a short time. And we said, now don't go in there and write about Cookie, but she had to. She went in there and she wrote about Cookie. And what she wrote, she just put down. And she came out of the room and she said, this is the first time in my life that I didn't have anything to do. All I had to do was to let him talk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
that was interesting.
Well, anyhow, it works. And you see, I could work to the Kingdom Come up on the campus, and I'd never get anything.
Mm-hmm.
If they'd been to Greece, they could tell you in a paragraph, and that's all.
With a topic sentence.
Yeah.
Beginning,
right.
A middle, and an end.
Yeah. Mm. Well, they might give you the passages, what connections they miss, and all. So, you see, in a way, you see, it makes artists suffer.
Mm-hmm.
It enables them to use their experience. Now that assumes they've had a little.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a rather uncommon thing. It's for one thing, it's curious what passes for experience now.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Hmm. Yeah, I'll send you another room.
I have to go get it. Yeah.
Well,
just open the door.
No, I just want a drink, Dad.
Do you, is Debbie going to pursue this kind of writing?
I don't know what she is. It's what happened to that. But what I was talking about, and you see, I've got all those records of the Miss Eastman and those.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd never thought about it. You know, they have a whole half of a floor over there devoted to the offices to sponsored research. Of course, it serves the whole university, and it's a huge university.
Mm.
And I got into that, and I didn't know how to make it out.
Mm-hmm.
And for one thing, you've got to make out a request. If you make out a request, you've got to make it under some heading, local history, oral history, that will interest somebody and enable them to file it.
Then they'll give you the money. They can just classify it, you see. It's the taxonomy. They can just put a name on it, then you get your money from it.
Well, they've got to file it, you know. They can't sit there and hold it. Whether you get the money or not.
You may cause them to close up.
And you see, I never knew anything about this. I never did any of this before, and I'm not a... And you gotta go in for archaeology and anthropology. And you've got to know technical terms that I don't know. I've dismissed them from my mind long ago. And the sociology and all like that. I've read a little here, then, yonder. And but you see, I can't cope with those people. I think I'm. It's just a sheer formality of the grant. You see, I might have something they want, but there's no chance of it meeting. Well, you did it the right way. If you do it through your department, you're much better off.
You can do it university-wide, but it's much harder. But then, the kind of projects I've been doing have always been very specific and things that were easy for the department to endorse, as long as they were willing to endorse me. But in your case, the project is more innovative and original and less ordinary, and so you're going to have more trouble, I think, getting people to just underwrite it right off. And then when you start trying to explain what it is, well, maybe you don't know exactly what it is, you know, but that's going to make it hard to get the money, you see. The thing they understand the most, these people who give out the money, is something very specific which will yield immediate results in the form of a book or some other scholarly activity. And usually they like to receive notice from you that you've written a book or an article or something within a fairly short period of time of the time you've had their money. But I should think that your chances of getting money would be better if you pushed the creative aspect of it and stressed more that students of creative writing and things like that might be interested in pursuing this kind of a project.
Well,
not exactly a writer's conference or something.
You see, I've got no allies.
You see, this is
actually goes against everything.
Well, right. Now,
Debbie is on my mind the reason I said that, but she wrote this little declaration that she was on her way, and she just had a few more things to do, and I wrote a little note. It was a beautiful little thing. And I wrote her back a little note, and I says, well, you needn't to. You just, I forget what this, a burn was in it. I said, you just stay up there and burn. I kind of forget it, how it was, but here's the thing. I had just seen Alton. And about some things that Rick was doing out here. And this is what Alton said. It was about the little revolution in Micanopy.
Mm-hmm.
They're trying to get the town council to work.
Mm-hmm.
And they want a, what do they call it, survey the town. They want to put restrictions.
Mm-hmm.
What do they call it, zone it.
Zone it.
And they'll never do it. But anyhow, that's what they want to do, and, you know, keep it the way it is. And Rick had gone to these meetings. He'd written them up, and he had he had innovated, and I helped him do it. He would start out and give it what went on,
mm-hmm.
and I told him, that he'd have to, if I knew Homer a little bit, see, I could tell you, but he's got to let Achilles stand up, you see, and brandish his sword a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
When Mr. Barr over here gets up and gives his report on the meters, he's got to turn it over to Mr. Barr,
mm-hmm.
and just act like that's all there is there, you see.
Mm-hmm.
He's got to adapt. In other words, what you're doing, you're making a sort of artistic adaptation of the minutes of the procedure over there. at work is readable.
Mm-hmm.
Alan said, yes, you just ought to do something with this. He says, well, he told Rick this, and I went by the next day, and he told me, he says, have you think maybe you better let him go over there with the creative writing people?
Mm-hmm.
He thought again, and he says, does he plan to take some graduate work, seminar? Well, now this is what works, Leslie. You see, he's going through all these experiences,
mm-hmm.
and it's not a part-time job. And if he takes a course, it's such concentrated knowledge, whatever it is, it'll pretty well shatter his experience.
Mm-hmm.
So it'll cool off. And the same thing in the writing. And this is where it's working out. I mean, the way it appears out here right now. Take Rick with his all that business about making open. Or Debbie with her summers in Greece and here, there, and yonder. Oh, she's had all sorts of experiences. Just remarkable. You'd be surprised just to know what the child's done. And she can fend for herself.
Mm-hmm.
And she does it all with such gusto. She doesn't know anything about creative writing. She's never been to graduate school either. She'll go over to the creative writer. And you know what they do? They break them in to all these techniques,
mm-hmm.
of these. You see, the writer's now all brainy. you don't have just half educated ones anymore. You see. The Erskine Caldwells will clear out. You got John and Crow Ransom and all those people. And if you see what they do, or T.S. Eliot, if you see what he does, you see,
mm-hmm.
you've got to be sort of PhD material. Right, now look what it does. By the time she sees it or gets sort of conditioned to it, to use all this experience she has, all this experience she has is going to cool.
Mm-hmm.
So she's going to have to start out and take another 2 or 3 years and get some more,
mm-hmm.
before she'll have anything to say in those short stories and novels. So what, in my mind, the way it works out is you've got to have some minor form. Before you get to T.S. Eliot.
Mm-hmm.
But they're legitimate.
Mm-hmm.
Just that little trip up that mountain there to the grandfather's old homestead. That's a form in itself.
Mm-hmm.
You don't need to go any further. Well, now you can improve it. You can carry it on just like you would a short story.
Mm-hmm.
But you see, in the academic world, nothing's recognized short of the big forms.
Mm-hmm.
So what they do, you see, what they do, Leslie, I see it. I see it all the time, you see. They get these classes of fine, sort of promising young people with their minds just eager. And all they do is squelch them.
Mm-hmm.
I've done enough of it myself. I ought to know what they do to them.
Look at Leslie.
You get people in there who want to know and want to write and want to do all those things, and you just drown them.
Let's see.
Now that's your academic world. So what I would have to specify is just a little respite from the academic world. I don't think you can, the way the world wags now, I don't think you can have a permanent respite from it. You see, with the world gone that way,
mm-hmm.
I mean, you can't. That's a jitney, and you're the only one to ride. Unless you want to write, work for the insurance company, and even then you got to have a PhD in insurance and a CPA. So it's not a, but at least, you see, so I don't have too many allies.
Mm-hmm. So that makes it hard for you to get the money.
Yeah, well, I don't care too much.
Well, I think the thing of it is, he's doing just the sort of thing that a number of people are doing,
mm-hmm.
and it's just, you know, three or four names have come up and they've done things. So if somebody just got the right tag. Because it needs to be done. All this stuff needs to be, have a staff to work on it. It just, if the university is going to use any of this stuff, it has to be made, put in usable form.
You know, if you listen to some of their reporting, you'd really be amazed at. And you see, that was in their culture, in learned. And you see, what we do now, you see, all of that is shattered with there's no space and no land and all, you see. So that's gone. We're just walking away from all that. And it can't exist any longer, much more. But you can at least see what we're leaving.
Mm-hmm.
And you, if you listen to that just a little bit, it would. What you do once you learn to listen, you see, it's they're kind of their own interpreters. You see, they you can just see the world through their eyes. Well, it's there's some extraordinary things. Now the reverse side of it, you see, they can't fend for themselves. They don't have the defenses that an educated person has, and they grade these roads. Well, that's about as poor a job as you can find. They just dig the road all over again every time they grade it, mostly. So, but in this particular way, you see their faculties in a right favorable light. It's curious.
Leslie, be interested, just because you've seen a little of this and you've also heard Guy talk, but I think it would please you to see these students who catch on to what Guy's doing,
mm-hmm.
and to see what devout disciples they are.
Oh yeah.
Now you see, in I look at I keep we keep up with each other. We talk a little music. Mm-hmm. But you see, you're not a disciple of mine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, except as we can talk about Mozart, and you remember little things that we did when we worked
mm-hmm.
together. And I may have helped you a little bit on the way. But in Guy's case, you see, it's almost a matter of changing the thought.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And he says to me, now when some of his good students leave, it's this, you know, they come along, and then he'll say, well, I guess I don't really have any influence on, you know, I mean, I don't guess they've really changed. And then he says, well, I know how you feel, because after having, I've had students as much as 10 years,
mm-hmm.
and they almost feel like I've, you know, we just, it's hard to see them go.
Mm.
But we keep up, like, you know, always there's a little something there, but it's such a real discipleship with these sellers who work along with Guy, like Rick.
Mm-hmm.
He worked all year in order to make enough money to come up here and spend the year just doing nothing but reading, writing, working with Guy.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
there's
a lot of things that go on with it.
Well, the thing that I was saying to him, though, was it's there. No matter years and years later, it'll be there.
Mm-hmm.
One. You see, I work mostly. Well, I work in all sorts of things, but I work. I always had a hand in, you know, something that was local, and. I don't have any literature now that I can use.
Yeah. And that's the thing that Debbie said. She said, you know, I've had all, she's an English major from Duke, and she said, I never had anyone tell me I was supposed to
use
it. Not working.
Now now you see, I'm interested. The people, the writers, I don't know, I do any of them, but the ones I seemingly think in terms of, you see, somebody from Franklin and Thoreau and Emerson
mm-hmm.
and Melville and Whitman. Well, you see, at Emerson Dickinson, I use them. You see, Emily Dickinson says art is what, it's not, how does she say that? It's not experience that gives you insight, but art.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I don't follow it just like that. See, you don't have to follow it just like that. But the thing I had worked with was, you see, I couldn't handle any of this stuff, and I had to somehow get hold of it, and that was what was so hard, and I didn't have hold of it, you see, and what I found was the process of thinking, of looking at it, was the damnedest thing. I can't do it by myself. I can't seem to do anything by myself. That fall, when I did the most, at least got a start, I had this little class. And we were reading Faulkner, The Bear, and Twain, Roughing It. That's the one Suzanne was in. And they were pretty tolerant. They went along with me. And I had those students to work with, and the writers. And then I had the people out here in the countryside, all pulling. And then the curious thing is the sort of key to it came from Channel 5. Edward Newman was interviewing Eric Fromm. Mm-hmm. That was all the dislocations he was talking about in that awful year, 67. And one of them, he said, was education. That also. Mm-hmm. It was mostly abstractions, like I said to you, which his students couldn't turn back into experience. And that was my term, you see. And there's the antithesis that goes through the whole thing. That's not the end of it, but that started it, enabled me to, you know, make other statements. So that's what they call the writers. I saw that term afterwards. They think of the writers now, you see, they're writing, and what you see there are the tensions that they're under. Fitzgerald, you see, always had that sort of secret pull towards the silk shirts and big neckties you see in the Great Gatsby era. And you see it in there, and then he knows that's not it, too, you see. So it's those things that pull them. So it's not an easy life. But the abstractions, I think, are what hinder them the most. We can't use them. You see, they use them all the time, but they're not using them. It's sort of an egghead. what does that mean, egghead? Egghead means they got a hold of something too big for them, and they just sort of bark at it.
Mm. Overly intellectual, maybe. Too clever and subtle.
Yeah. It's most of it's egghead, where they pare it down, you see, if they could pare down some of their next alphabet.
That term came in with Stevenson.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
His wife used it.
Yes. His ex-wife.
He's an egghead now.
Well,
that was the reason she left him.
Well, I think he was probably too smart for her as he was for the rest of us. He was one of the last good men in politics, probably. But
yeah.
He was too smart for the public.
Well, I'll tell you guys, my experience with Leslie from way back is that he can put things right straight. You might just let him see. He could write out your grant.
Yes, he could do it.
Sure he could. He wouldn't even have to know.
It might be better if I didn't.
Just
give me the form and I'll fill it out.
That would be the thing to do. Just let him fill it out. As a matter of fact, this is what one of the key men has told me. It doesn't matter what you
Well, this is what was told me once. Let me tell you a little secret. I had a Woodrow Wilson dissertation fellowship, you know, and I wrote up this big grant application, and Mr. Dow, who was going to direct the dissertation, was in Greece at the time, and he was frantically working to get me access to these sherds, the pieces of pottery, that had been found down at Corinth, and they had little inscriptions, little letters on them, and they were supposed to be from the archaic period, from the very early period, which means they'd be difficult and full of philological problems, and might be interesting to me, and probably would be a dissertation. The first article I wrote, you know, was on a Corinthian inscription that had already been published, and I'd just written that, and he said, well, let's follow this up, and you'll have your dissertation out in no time, and all we have to do is for me to get these sherds away from Mr. Bagehold, who is an old pupil of mine anyway, so I'll just write him a letter and say, well, you're too busy to do these, let's give them to Leslie. So, I wrote up the application for the grant and everything and said what I was going to do, and I said, but Mr. Dow, we haven't even looked at the sherds. How do we know that there's anything there, you know? Aren't we being overly optimistic? And he says, oh, well, don't worry about what you put on the form, because basically it's the person that counts, not the project. And, of course, what happened was I mailed the thing off to the Woodrow Wilson people, and they eventually gave me the grant, actually. But eventually I got down to the bus station and went down to Corinth and took a look at the box of sherds. And there are only about 20 of them in there. It was just one little cigar box. And we had certainly been led to believe that there were hundreds. There were about 20 little sherds, and each one of them had about one or maybe two letters on them. I made drawings and sketchings of the entire collection in about 3 hours and was ready to take the afternoon bus back to Athens. I had fully expected to stay down there for 3 or 4 days and had reserved a room and everything, but, I mean, I just looked at them and you know, made etchings of them, and I had all of the texts right there on a piece of paper, and there were only two of them that were more than two letters, I think, and they were only 4 or 5 letters, and they didn't yield any sense at all. They were very fragmentary, very small. So I got back to Athens feeling quite discouraged about this, and then Mr. Dow suggested another project, and when the grant came, I just did that project for my dissertation, and it was quite satisfactory. They never went back and saw that I didn't do the Corinthian sherds. So they couldn't have cared less. But that is true. The specific project is sometimes not so important as the person directing it. But I certainly know the jargon, I think, for getting grants, you know, for filling out the forms.
You've had enough.
There is a time when you have to be not quite as specific, because every project is, to some extent, indefinite until you actually complete
it. You see,
if you were finished with it, you wouldn't need the money.
You see, I don't want it for myself. I want it to cover other equipment. Unless I could get $45,000, it won't help me.
Mm-hmm. That would really be difficult, though.
Yeah,
such a large amount of money.
For a couple of years.
Do you want the money primarily to support these students who will be working on the material, or is it to buy a lot of stuff?
No, he's bought the stuff, and
he's
spent
bought
that much money, at least himself, on it.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I need a full-time man for 6 months just getting the stuff in shape.
Mm-hmm. And you would prefer that this person be like a student, say, a graduate student, or?
I know, I'd like to get someone to handle the tapes who's, you don't have to be a student.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It might be easier to get the money if there was some way you could work it. So, is Suzanne still a student out here at Florida, or?
No, right, not at the moment. She's gone out. Jim got a job.
Mm-hmm. But you don't have specific people in mind to do this, or you're going to hire them after you get the money?
I would have to have them in mind, you see.
You'd have to have them in mind, right.
Because it would take too long to.
I wouldn't have to have them all at one time. Mm-hmm. I couldn't handle them at one time. It's too
Well, I suppose it depends on whom you want to get the money from. For a while, the National Endowment for the Humanities was passing out a lot of money for very innovative projects.
Yeah.
But they seem to have reversed themselves. They have a new director now, and he's much more interested in the grammar of Attic inscriptions than my type of project. For better or for worse, they're now fighting, I think, in that. And it'll be interesting to see which group comes out on top. But right now, it's the Harvard-type projects are the ones that are getting the money, the straight, old-fashioned ones. So that might not be a very good place to apply. Who is it that you're actually thinking of applying to through the university? Anybody? You haven't actually gotten any forms from anybody then.
I've been on it very long, and I found it very hard to get information.
Guess it would be.
And even with people who had experience.
Yeah.
So what happened is Rick just somehow or other picked it up, and he can go over there and talk to them and have a glorious time.
Mm-hmm.
If I go and talk to them, we'll start slashing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, this is something that we had to learn. The person who creates the project shouldn't have to sell it.
Yeah, that's right, I think.
Mm-hmm.
But
I mean...
It seems to me that it would be maybe fairly easy for somebody like Rick to get money if he would just register at the university. And he could perhaps get him some kind of a grant to do whatever he wanted to do as a creative writer, and he could work for you. But it would be much harder for you to... and then even if he doesn't ever finish up or get a degree, I mean, they're not going to come back and beat the money out of him or anything like that. A lot of people, as students, accept grants for one thing or another, and they don't exactly spend the money on drink, but it just doesn't ever, their education doesn't continue for one reason or another. And that doesn't mean that they weren't entitled to the money, not by a long shot. And nobody's ever really going to check on that. But it would be much harder for you to obtain the money, I think, partly because you need such a large amount. Say he could apply for $4,000 or $5,000 maybe and get it. So, I don't know. Guggenheim is a possibility, but they tend to be rather conservative, I think, and give money primarily to established people. Mr. Dow got a Guggenheim the year he went to Greece, and he was on the board. He awarded it to himself. I mean, that's the kind of thing that they do. I know a couple young scholars who've gotten Guggenheims, and their projects have been basically, I want to go write a book on the magistracies of the Roman Republic in South Italy in the period 100 to 50 BC. Will you give me the money? They did. And this fellow was a graduate of Oxford and a colleague of mine at Berkeley. And that's the type of people would get money from them, so I don't really think it would be possible. Private foundations might be a possibility.
Well,
but the traditional sources of money that I know about are not so good unless there somehow is tied into the project either some immediate publishable product or it's meshed in the university in some way so that the kids working on it will eventually complete degrees. Then I think it might sell. But otherwise, the Guggenheim and the American Council of Learned Societies and those various groups, National Endowment for the Humanities, they aren't very innovative or liberal at all. I mean, basically they serve the scholarly establishment. They pass out money to the pupils of Harvard professors and others who are doing worthwhile research, but it's not innovative in character, and it follows traditional methodology and lines.
You know, I never really thought about it. I never paid much attention to it. The graduate school never interested me.
Mm.
On the last year, I spent just about all of my spare time casing the drawings, find some niche
mm-hmm.
in the department or in the university.
Mm-hmm.
And what I saw, it was there all the time. they get a few graduate professors. Of course, the graduate professors are a little different now. They have more of them. But they still have.
They're all still the same.
They still have the stars amongst them. And what it does, Leslie, it just wrecks the britches off the whole department, feeding those graduate professors.
Yeah.
Just feeding the students to them.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
And then the department still are never satisfied. They're always looking for some other line item. Big one. Where they can get John, what do you call it, Nims, this poet in residence this time. Now they want to keep him.
Mm-hmm.
And he writes poetry in several languages.
Rainy type, I guess.
And why they need
John
Frederick Nims, and why they need an international figure like that here, and all it can do is just strain them and put the squeeze on so many of the lesser ones, smaller ones.
Mm-hmm.
It's just like whoever gets to be president is as 100,000 D-12 bulldozers in this country. He somehow got to get enough roads going to keep them at work.
Yeah.
Now that's a happy thought. Make you sleep at night.
Eventually, I'll have nothing at all. Well.
But I just looking at it from the senior side, you see. They do very fine work.
They do, but they are over-professionalized, I think, and what happens, at least in classics, is that the discipline is so little studied now by students that as you go closer and closer to the top, as the work gets more and more advanced, there are fewer and fewer students who are interested in pursuing it. So this means that in our advanced courses at Berkeley, we have a very small number of students. So it's advantageous to us to have at the bottom a much larger group, so that as the attrition takes place going up to the top, you have enough people left to fill out our advanced courses in Greek and Latin. We don't have two separate tiers in the department, fortunately. We don't have a group of older men who are stars who do all the graduate teaching and the rest of us do all the dirty work teaching the large classes. We don't have that set up at all. Everybody has exactly the same teaching assignment. I teach one graduate course and another type of course, and each of us does that. But
yeah, they've changed they've done that.
But still, people don't often ask the question if it's really the best use of resources.
Well, but look at the strain that puts on everybody in that first tier. And it directing them towards something that they don't need.
Right. And I'll admit the whole system is bad, but if just a whisper got out that the whole system was bad, what they would do in Sacramento would just be to red pencil the classics department.
Well, they'd red pencil all of them.
And then you'd have nothing left in the humanities at all.
I don't think there's any danger of red penciling any one department. All right. I mean, they're all
certainly
the
in the humanities, they're very much in the same boat.
I don't know. Hell, they, God Almighty, I was an engineer for 6 months one time. And those professors down there, once they get a student, they take him out and dine him.
I know what you mean.
Uh-huh.
I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So
I don't feel honest. I mean, just when you see the job situation in the classics, you just really can't pull the wool over their eyes that way. I mean, you're preparing them for a very grim future. They don't have any sense. They still want to study it, so you might as well wine and dine them until they finish up and meet the horror of reality. What makes it attractive is if you keep telling them that there are no jobs and there's no future in it, they'll never let go. Even if they have no aptitude or real interest, they'll hang on just because of the opposite business. So.
You know, you know, I keep saying, I keep, as I see these things now, you see, I work with the younger people, and when I work with them, I watch them. I just see how their minds work as well as I can see. And one thing I noticed in Debbie, now how she got it, I don't know. The reason I mentioned her, I've just been working with her. She's the only one out of her whole class that isn't going to graduate school.
Mm-hmm.
And still, as she says, she's university bred. And when she was growing up, all of her friends were PhDs,
mm-hmm.
their parents' friends.
Mm-hmm.
Well, one thing that she does that I don't see the others doing she just has an unlimited appetite for what I'd call experience, and she keeps up with any number of people, and she not only keeps up with them with postcards, but she just keeps up with them.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not. It seemed like something that used to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then I think of, all the things I was exposed to, and I played my chances. There wasn't any lack of that. And I made a headway every time, you see, but I never could quite make it. I simply didn't quite get far enough. And the one thing, you see, you'd say, well, at least you had plenty of experience. I didn't. I think Debbie has already got more experience than I ever had. I had a certain focus in my mind that cut out a great deal.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you see, just like I monitor these stations. Sometimes some of the news I will listen to, so I won't.
Oh, you're talking about that you never quite made it in the experience. Yeah.
And you see, I won't have anything to do with sports,
mm-hmm.
and I got nothing against sports, except what I see is, once you turn on sports, it's just unlimited. It's just no end.
It's just
end. But still, I turn it off. And the mind's not supposed to do that. I don't know how the mind's supposed to do it. But mine never did do quite right. Well, almost got there, but never quite, you see. And I've done that again and again and again. And again. So, it's just the way my mind works. And one thing I see is that the focus was always too great. And where in the hell I got that focus, I don't know.
just like
almost ascetic.
That's right.
Almost ascetic, you see.
He's going to sit on a pole like Bede if he doesn't rock.
Yes, almost. Well, you see, I see those things. And I see Rick works out here. I've seen a good bit of Rick. Now he has a mentality that I was never even close to. He grew up in Winn-Dixie, and he actually grew up in it. And he didn't realize how much he grew up in it. When he came up here, he wrote for months at his typewriter on his experiences as a bag boy. And he made some extraordinary things at it he didn't know he knew, you see.
He didn't even like it.
Well, but even so, he is conscious of one saying about present day things. That he said his daddy and the hierarchy down there had some dishes that they got. They were beautiful dishes, and they got them for nothing. And all they had to do was that the cashier, when she added up the bill, she says, "Now for an extra nickel, you can have this fine dish." And what happened was, it worked all right for an hour or two, and then it got mechanical, and then she says, "5 cents extra, you can have this beautiful dish." And that's what Rick can see. He sees the process. And I don't see it. I don't see it, you see. I'm not supposed to. We went down to the, I had to get a driver's license, and we went down there. And I tried to ask the man which line to get in, and he wouldn't answer me. He said, "Getting the first one, that's wrong." And I had to get another one. We stood over there, and Rick was just in there with me, and I had on my old clothes, like up here at the ranch, and we were both using our outdoor voice, or I was. And what was happening, they had two men, one at the typewriter filling out the blanks, and one over here who did things and directed people how to test their own eyesight. Mm-hmm. And I was standing over here talking, just killing the time, and that outdoor voice, and he couldn't hear. I perfectly oblivious to it, see. He couldn't get mad at me because I wasn't doing it on purpose. But it lasted all the time with him. And the boy up the typewriter looked at me once twice and he says, "Shh." And I thought to myself, who's he talking to?
And Rick, so everything is going on in that place. Everything
you
should
do. So you see, I'm not.
And God didn't see anything.
Well, you see, I'm not good at that. But he sees that all along. I mean, the whole shebang. He can see it.
Wouldn't it be terrible, though, if you just... Yeah. Everybody had the same focus.
Well.
We haven't even heard a thing about what Les is up to.
No.
Haven't been up to anything great, sorry.
Not one thing.
What I wanted to know, this is getting to be a shop talk, was how they bleed him out there working so hard. I didn't know he worked so hard out there.
I don't believe he's worked so hard this fall.
No.
Have you, Lester? You look so healthy.
Well, I've been working about as hard as I was like this fall. I gave... Well, a Latin course was new, but it had a very few people in it, so I didn't have to do too much for that. But the other course, which is the one I give every year, Introduction to Graduate Study, and I make it just as conservative and as unapproachable and horrible as possible. Usually one or two drop out before the end of the first month, but I feel that that's what they should get first, so that they'll realize it's not any bed of roses. And graduate education in the classics is really a
highly technical, professional training, basically. That's not what you just want to... I mean, I'm sorry it's that way, but that's the way it is. You want to get a graduate degree and a job, and you might as well do some of this. But usually I have 5 or 6 people in the course, and this year I had 14. I started out with 15, and then one girl dropped, so I had 14 people. And it was just a rat race. I didn't even know their names until almost Thanksgiving, and I have each one of them give an oral report in class, and then they write it up at the end. This is to give them practice in giving seminar reports, so that when they take seminars in the department, they won't be totally inexperienced in this. That's one of the things this course, it's an introductory course, is supposed to do. But just to schedule all of their reports in the amount of class time we had proved to be a physical impossibility. So I had them to my house for supper on a Saturday night and tried to get, well, we had 3 reports before dinner, and we just couldn't have any more after that. They were famished and I was exhausted, and but we still didn't get everybody in. So it was a bit of a rat race from that point of view. But today, for example, I did recommendations, which I also did yesterday and the day before. The longer you stay at a place, the more work comes your way.
Yeah.
And you can't tell students that you'd rather not write them a recommendation. I mean, unless you're an ogre. I mean, unless you feel that they're not good and would rather not, then I think you're perfectly justified. But after you've been there for 2 or 3 years, you know so many of the students that when they start applying for graduate study, you're just inundated with requests for recommendations. I do mine with Carbon, so I hope that Harvard doesn't mind if it gets my statement about the student and Carbon not having been the top of the pile when it went into the typewriter. But every form is different, so you can't do too much with Carbons. But that kind of work is just always coming your way in enormous amounts. And that's the kind of work that I certainly have absolutely no interest in. I mean, the purely clerical, pencil-pushing type of thing. Writing recommendations, writing letters, answering letters.
It takes a great deal of paperwork down and gets them into graduate school.
Yes, it does. They charge them $20 a piece, I think, per application, and that supposedly is just to pay for the cost of processing the application. Now, after Christmas, I'm on the committee for admissions and fellowships, and we will start meeting, and we will go through all of these applications. Hopefully the chairman of the committee will pare it down some, throwing out the bad ones, but you know, it takes a lot of time when you have 5 people getting together and trying to agree on who should get in and who shouldn't. One of the discouraging things about this year is that even though there were so many in this introductory course, they were not good on the whole.
Yeah.
Last year we only had 6 in there, but 4 of them were really outstanding, among the best students I've seen. Interesting, bright, intelligent, had ideas, imaginative, and very well prepared in their ancient languages. They knew their Greek and their Latin quite well. But this year, on the whole, the students were more pedestrian and not so well prepared in the ancient languages, and not so imaginative, and just more numerous. And I found the course a bit of a drag to run. But I think that the quarter system is the really big offender. If that could be changed, I believe that I'd be able to function normally,
yeah,
even with 6 courses a year. But this thing is just... I mean, I will just be starting right up again right after Christmas with 2 completely new courses. Actually, they're both things I've given before, so it shouldn't be so bad. But it's just... And then, you know, you just have a week in March before the spring one starts, and then it's all starts up again. Could never catch your breath.
I don't think we'll ever get away from the quarters.
I don't think we'll ever get rid of it either.
It just seems to be a part of the mentality now.
I'm afraid so. Places like Cornell and Harvard still don't have it, though, so Yale doesn't have it either, so there is hope.
Well, don't you feel what, I don't know what kind of courses you give now, but don't you just feel you just get started and then it's over and you really don't have time to do anything?
Yeah, you're constantly gearing up.
Yeah, you never really...
You're constantly trying to find out who they are.
Right.
By the time you sort of have an idea of who half of them are, you see you've got a whole new set.
Leslie, I didn't know you could report. That was, they were two good ones, he sent, weren't they, guys?
Yes, they were.
They were.
Yes.
You even brought them to life.
Let me see.
I didn't know a classical scholar
could do that. One of them you got lost in the vineyard with the broom sage or something.
That's right. The real.
And what was the other, the marriage? Where?
Oh, the marriage.
Somebody
was so funny.
Trying to.
Yeah.
The old priest.
Oppose it with.
That was so funny.
Oppose it with
all sorts of calamities.
All sorts of means there.
By red tape.
Red tape primarily, which
yeah.
is the ancient Greek means of opposing anything, really. It's
yeah.
red tape. That was really something. The thing about that one that was so funny was that the people were so hypocritical right up until the end that really, no one had any inkling about what was going on until my friend was shown the letter. He had no idea that his uncle, who was the priest of the village, was doing everything in his power to prevent marriage. Because they were all so friendly, and they'd given them the best room in the house, which was
yeah.
his uncle's own house.
Yeah.
Oh, it was just, it was really like something out of ancient Greek literature. So completely hypocritical and... Goodness. Well,
now, Leslie, if you there's no doubt about it. Now, if you did some of this in your own language, you would see a great deal more than you would in another language.
You mean if I dealt with literature in my own language, like?
Well, that wasn't literature. That was just people in the village.
Oh, I see what you mean. If I were to do, say I were to go hiking around here somewhere instead of in the Greek islands, I'd have much more to, you might be right, I don't know.
Well, they are...
Because Leslie's a little bit more at home in the Greek language than...
Yeah.
Yes, but he's still not native, you know.
Yeah.
No, that's true.
That's
and
right.
I always look at them with a somewhat... there's always a smirk. I'm afraid I don't join them quite.
Yeah.
I like them an awful lot, but they do have peculiar habits. No doubt about it. You know, one thing that happened to me that was most infuriating thing I think that's ever happened in a long time, and I could not do anything about it. I was completely frustrated. There was this monastery, it was a convent, right up above the town of Naxos. You go straight up on this sun-baked mountain. It's about an hour's walk up there, and you see it up there. And it is so hot getting up there, and I went up there in the middle of the morning. I thought, well, I'll go up and I'll ring the bell, and they'll let me in, and they'll give me some water, and it'll be nice and cool inside, and it'll be worth it. I can take a picture from the front or something. Obviously, there'd be a nice view of the harbor. So I tramped up there, and when I got up there, there were these two old women inside the gate, talking to each other in a very loud tone of voice. I don't know what they were talking about. One of them was younger than the other, and they were talking about life and how hard it was, and if you didn't get a good husband, it was bad, and all this and that. And I knocked, and I rang the bell, and I did everything in my power to try to get them to open that door. I wanted to see the monastery, for one thing. And they just absolutely ignored me. They did not even... Their voices didn't even pause, you know. They didn't... I think they must have been stone deaf, except that they were talking to each other. They just went right on with whatever they were saying. Their voices never even flagged, you know.
Yeah.
And I couldn't get in out of the sun, and I had nothing to do but walk all the way back down, waiting about 10 minutes.
Well, you... For one thing, now... For one thing, you got your your method of doing it, of well, if you see anything much, you don't see it accidentally. And you know, just to take sort of loose examples, I don't go to cocktail parties anymore because they're no use to me. I can't. I've got no chance. I can't. there's absolutely no way I can. I can't hardly speak to anybody. You know, I'm just lucky if I get to speak to a few people. Well, now you just extend that on until you, what you do, you choose your own ground. And then, you see, you've got to make something happen. Until, now that's what, that's in Faulkner, that's one of the beautiful things, that's in Faulkner's story of the Hamlet, that's the one he got the Nobel Prize for. And what he's got in there, Ratcliffe is a narrator, except he don't bother too much with that. He lets him narrate a little bit and then he lets him rest. And I think that's fine. And he gives you a picture of Ratcliffe listening. You'll find him at the crossroads where the stores are. You'll find him squatting.